Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
August 30th, 2016, episode number 98, Utter Insanity. Focus. This is the word that comes to mind these days. It is beekeeping 24/7 here lately as the focus to keep the operation going in the right direction weaves itself into the nooks and crannies of everyday life. I wouldn't have it any other way, but it does wake me up at 3 o'clock in the morning last night. Hi everyone, this is Kevin England back with you again. I see I'm a few days late again, but you'll have to forgive me for one thing trumps talking about bees, and that centers on actually being a beekeeper and not a beehaver. Of course, home chores, beekeeping association obligations, and other odds and ends enter into the mix, but as you'll hear, it has been a treadmill of beekeeping activities lately. So what do I have in store for you this go-round? We'll talk about a topical story in segment one concerning handling of antibiotics in the U.S. Segment two, I'll bring you part two of my adventures in Italy. Roundtable one involves a different aspect of feeding bees. Roundtable two is a tip to remember queen colors. Roundtable three involves a visit to Bob's Bee Emporium. There might be a roundtable four somewhere in there, but I guess I'm going to go long with this episode with what I already have. And toward the closing, we'll talk about current events and such. We'll see if there's a roundtable that crops its head up in there. I'm not sure. Lots to cover, so let's jump in the deep end. Before I dive into the local hive report, let me share that you can write me at kevin@bkcorner.org. Given the email, you could probably tell that the website is bkcorner.org. And that's enough of that. Okay, onward and upward. No messing around this week. The Local Hive Report. The title of this episode, Utter Insanity, is related to the Local Hive Report and the craziness that has become my hives. I'm late in my actions and what I'm doing is highly suspect, but I have an agenda and I'm hoping the bee gods will be kind and let me get away with what I have in store for my hives. Let me give the rundown. In my local yard, meaning my backyard, I have a few new hives. The first was a two-frame nuc that Bob Kloss shared with me. He had it in a queen castle. He had it in reserve, and I've taken it on to see if I can do something with it. I placed it into a five-frame nuc this week and intend to feed and feed and feed to see if I can get it to overwinter. The game plan with this hive and all the others is to build a Bob Kloss nuc condo. If you're not familiar with that, you're a new listener, it's where we take all these nucs and stack them together, wrap them in foam, insulating foam, and see if we can share the warmth between them and get them to overwinter. It's a significant task that is fraught with peril, but let's see how it progresses for this particular hive. At minimum, if I can't get this hive going fast enough, I'm going to consider putting it in a three-frame observation hive that I borrowed from our association and see if I can overwinter it in the house. At minimum, it's a shame to see it go to waste, so we'll see what we can do here. I know at some point I could also combine it with another, although I'm not sure what I'd do with the queen, but you know, we'll see. We'll get to Thanksgiving or we'll get to Halloween and we'll make a judgment call on that. So that one's sitting on the first pad in my yard. On the second pad, I have what I call the gateway hive. It has three deeps on it and on last inspection is moderate and probably requires treatment. It was on the threshold when I checked it. This is the one that I have on the hive scale. And it's lost about 10 pounds, maybe more like 7 since July. We're in a bit of a dearth here in New Jersey. This is after we took some honey off of it, that it's lost that additional weight. It's still got enough stores to get it through without any problem. I suspect it's ramping down, which means the mites are probably taking over. And we'll keep an eye on it and make sure it has good foundation for fall. I did a mite check. It was right at the threshold. This weekend I'm going to pull it apart, do another mite check, see where it is, and just make sure that it hasn't creeped up and doesn't require treatment. The third pad has the 8-frame hive, which came from a split earlier this year out of our 2015 package hive over the farm. It's hanging in there, and as of Monday night, I started to feed it, so they'll build up a bit again. Again, you know, we're working towards overwinter state. I don't intend to monitor or treat this hive as it was a split and had a brood break, and I don't think that the mite load should be high in it. The fourth pad has two nuke boxes on it. I took this swarm that came into the breezeway on the day that I left for India this summer and split it into two nukes. It's doing great in the first nuke. It has the original queen and she's going to town. It's ready for additional boxes, and like the others, I'll continue to feed it and build it up in preparation for inclusion in the nuke condo. The second one was a little bit more behind the first one because it didn't have a queen and had to raise one. In the last 2 weeks, it raised a queen. She's been out, been mated, and as of 2 days ago, I saw eggs all the way through one of the frames. And the queen is spectacular, just gorgeous. So I'm feeding both of these hives and plan to get them to at least two stories. Now, I have a metal frame, if you've ever watched the videos that we shoot from the yard. And the plan for that was always going to be the platform for the nuke condo. It's got a good start on that, because today it has two nukes on it. One is the half of the Kingwood swarm split from the farm. I split that one this past week. And the other is a swarm that we captured over the weekend. The Kingwood The Kingwood Hive Swarm Nuke got a new queen that again was donated by Bob. He had some excess around. This thing is a little bit moderate. So over at the farm, the Kingwood Hive box that came from a hive that started on the last day of May this year was built out to 9 of the 10 frames. When I made the split, I left 5 frames really strong and left that over at the farm with the original queen. I took the remaining 4 frames and the one that was a dud over, and I put a queen in this hive. I used the queen introduction device that I bought one time from Kelly. And this morning, I opened that and watched the queen crawl out and enter into that hive. It looks like they've accepted her. I checked it tonight. And again, I'm going to feed and see if we could build this to two stories before winter. Bob assures me that all of these nukes are just cranking machines. And the good news for us is that I start to see goldenrod now up and around. And the acetum is ready to go. So the fall plants are coming a little bit early this year. And I'm hoping they have a long run all the way through to November. So I'm going to feed the snot out of that hive. The other nuke box that's sitting on that metal frame is a swarm we captured this past weekend. I have very little hope over this, although the queen is absolutely spectacular looking. One of Bob's queens, she's huge, plump, black as can be, Carniolian queen. But the difficulty here is that the queen was, we put her in a queen cage, and they haven't released her yet. And there's only a couple cups of bees with us, as we didn't have a good time. I'll tell the story of this a little bit later out in Roundtable. I'm going to look through my other hives and see if I could find some frames to donate to the cause. But again, a swarm this time of year is usually not worth its weight, but we'll see if this one has any prospects. So switching over to the farm, things are mostly status quo. Of course, I mentioned the split, that I split the one hive, and now that nuke is really strong sitting back there. The other activity that took place over the farm is Bob donated some top bar frames to help me prop up my top bar that I have operating over the farm. It was kind of building out, but probably needs a little bit of help. It had the equivalent of about 5 or 6 frames worth of bees. They're building wonky comb. Bob had a small top bar hive that he used all season to build out resources for his full-size top bars. It's a top bar in miniature. It only had about 8 or 10 frames in it, and he's been using recycling the stuff that they're creating to supplement his. And now he's done with it for the season, and he didn't want to try and overwinter it. And it made sense to see if we could prop up my top bar and take those 5 or 6 frames and put them in addition to my 6 frames. So now my top bar has about 12 frames. The timing of this, as I said, is good timing because the goldenrod over the farm is just starting to break. And I think if they get a good flow there, they'll be able to build out a lot of resources. My hope is that that hive probably has the ambition to build 35 to 40 frames when it's at full strength. If it can get to half of those and fill half that chamber, I think we can get it to overwinter. So I have my fingers crossed. The other thing that Bob gave me was a feeder out of the hives that he has. The shape of the feeder doesn't fit in my hive, but at least it gave me an idea of how to build a feeder for my hive, so I have a garage project to do this week. I can't thank him enough for allowing me to have those excess resources to prop up my hives. I know he gets frustrated at times with me trying to get my operation under solid footing and is willing to help me, and I know he listens, so Bob, thanks. I can't thank you enough for helping a friend out here. And, you know, I know Bob has resources and he helps others, and my hope is that eventually I'll build enough resources that I'll be able to pay it forward. So there is an ultimate plan for all of this. So one final note about the local hive report. I performed some mite checks on my hives over there and just got in some Apivar that I had to order. I didn't have any. The all-medium one, for example, was really disconcerting. It has a very high threshold. I think I mentioned 28 mites total in the sample of a half cup. So I have it primed this week. If I can get a day where I could sneak out of work and get in, break those hives open when it's not 7:30 at night and getting to be dark, I'm going to stick my Apivar treatments in that and a couple other ones that certainly need them. I'm really behind, but given the nature of my summer, it just couldn't be helped. And at least this weekend coming up is a holiday and I'll get an extra day. So at minimum, it won't get past this weekend before everything gets its due attention. It could be noted that I spent some time this past week painting equipment. The nuke boxes that I spoke of came from my garage inventory. I built them last year out of scrap wood that I had, and they all had to be painted before being put into service. I ordered a few bottom boards and supporting equipment, and it all had to be prepped. And like usual, early mornings and late nights keep things going. Work timelines, meaning BMS, where I work, are not very flexible, and I've been burning the candle from both ends lately. That being said, the beekeeping season will end, and I'm fully committed to making things work. I think I should be committed for utter insanity, but that's for another day. Segment number one, the title of this one is Antibiotics. The world as we know it is about to change. As I say this, I'm imagining the collective groans and applause from beekeepers and people who are going to be on both sides of this particular discussion. It's funny how some perceive the world, and in my estimation, similar to the reason that we have different political parties in this great nation of ours, who do you stand with and what you wish for is probably rooted in your belief system. As I talk about this, the beekeeping press is starting to get to that threshold where the inevitable conclusion that the way antibiotics are going to be governed for livestock in this country are due to change at the end of this year. Since bees, in the guise of government thinking, are livestock, the regulation of using antibiotics for beekeeping practices is in scope. The good versus evil aspect of this has several layers. First, the practical matter is that if your bees have problems, there are time-tested practices to apply certain antibiotics to address the situation. In the case of bee diseases, beekeepers have been trained to keep an eye on American foulbrood, European foulbrood, and other maladies. Some, as a practical matter, can be treated with terramycin, for example, but the problem lies with overzealous, uninformed, inexperienced applications that see solutions being applied incorrectly or prophylactically, and harm is being done as a result. I suspect that we beekeepers, concerning this topic, are not the target of the legislation, but the recipients of a greater good when it comes to livestock, as far as the government is concerned, and therefore caught in the snare of the wide net that is encompassed in the Veterinary Feed Directive, VFD, legislation that is going into effect in January 2017. There was, in my estimation, no great threat in beekeeping or its industry that is confounding the government about the widespread use of antibiotics. But now we have a new way of working to embrace. This new way of working is going to be awkward. A vet will now have to be consulted, as the common products that we all had accessible to us will now come via a prescription, and beekeeping supply houses will not be able to provide them to us through their catalogs any further. I could go off on a tangent and debate the merits as to whether this is a good or bad thing, but don't care to get into that discussion. I simply state that there are opinions that people apply this stuff with little knowledge of what they're doing, and it's flat out wrong. On the other side, there are those who are experienced and understand the efficacy of the applications, and now they have to rely upon another to take action, and this could be a new challenge in the world. It would be one thing if veterinarians were practicing beekeeping, since bees are classified as food animals, but the fact of the matter is, it seems reasonable to assume that the vast majority of vets will have no clue and will likely have a courting period of learning should they care to engage. Like anything else, in time this will work itself out, and how vets will engage will be established. Whether they embrace the notion and become a valuable partner and bring expertise to our industry, which would be a good thing, will be known in time, but I suspect that it simply will become some impractical outcome that beekeepers will lament as bad legislation for years to come, because the government did something for feed and we happen to be caught again in the snare of the net. In my eyes, and I'll share this personal viewpoint, I haven't had a need for antibiotics. I've never applied them, and therefore, personally, I'm not overly concerned about this. I would assume that our state apiarist will assess the situation, and if a foulbrood outbreak came to town, would provide us with the guidance in accordance with the state agency practice, as that is his remit. I'm honestly not inclined to use antibiotics unless my hive is sick, and even then, I would only use them as a last resort, and do all that I could to let nature run its course, which includes, by the way, letting a colony succumb if that's the best course of action. Now, before you get squeamish about that statement, let me add some context so you don't think I'm a monster. My thought process is a sick hive is going to be small and meek, and at the time, illness is taking over, and intervention is probably not warranted in the first place. It seems to me that strong, healthy colonies, again in my estimation, typically never get in a position to require interventions. They just do their thing. So in the end, this topic is going to blossom as beekeepers across the U.S. come to the reality of the new ways of doing things. Discussing this has me wondering how many people are stockpiling for Armageddon, as I'm guessing there's a few fringe elements out there that are going to go on that bent. In addition, there are several who are cheering from the rafters that this wanton disregard for circumventing nature through the modern medicine is finally being closed. To me, I simply hope that after 2017, my fortunes do not make this a difficulty, and that our friends in all circles of beekeeping the locals, the sideliners, the commercial operations could somehow find a way to adjust and move along with little impact, as I don't know anyone who needs or benefits from further difficulties in their lives. If you're interested in learning more, there was a feature in Bee Culture magazine this past week that overviews the details of the veterinary feed directive and what can be expected. Visit our show notes for a link to the article. You could also search on the web. It's called Honeybee Antibiotics Won't Be Over the Counter After Jan 1. Get ready. Segment number 2 is appropriately Italy Part 2. Before I go in this, I wanted to just recount an oops on my part. Italy Part 1, in the last episode, I made a comment that I didn't remember the person's name that I met with at Co-op Melissa, but then moments later I knew his name was Massimo. I had that moment while I was recording that I didn't want to say his name wrong, and I made that comment, but I knew his name was Massimo. In fact, I have his name, I have a business card, and I also wanted to mention that his business partner's name was Mario. In listening back to the episode, that kind of bothered me, so I wanted to clear that up before I dived in here and make that correction. So let me tell you the story of Italy Part 2. All week long I had, as I said, asked people, do you know any beekeepers? Well, the night that I drove back to my hotel from Co-op Melissa, I came through the lobby and the nice lady at the counter called me over. She was really excited, and what she had explained to me in broken English is that she found a beekeeper for me. Now, I was thinking of what I was going to do that Saturday, and it turns out that she had arranged a meeting for me at 9 o'clock. And the funny part was, she was trying to explain it to me, but couldn't speak English, and handed me two pieces of paper. One of them said, Togliere Papa Real, had the name Giancarlo on it, 9 o'clock, and a phone number. The second note had Giancarlo's name, phone number, and an address. And on the back of it was a diagram, handwritten, that showed the bus depot, which I recognized from my travels. There's this really big bus depot, probably about 3 miles from the place where I was staying, and said Bar Green Apple on it. And I didn't understand the context of that, but I think what she tried to relay to me was, go to the Green Apple Bar. So dazed and confused, I returned to my room and ruminated on what she had said to me, and I surmised that at 9 a.m. the next morning, I was supposed to go to this Green Apple Bar and meet with Giancarlo. That was my guess as to what she was trying to tell me. So that's exactly what I did. I prepped all my stuff, and I was there at 9:15 and sat there till about 9:15, and nobody showed up. Nobody feigned interest in me. And it's a bar. It was serving breakfast. The restaurant was open, but only one or two cars came, and nobody even looked at me when they pulled in. So I had prepared an alternate plan, because I thought it was really strange that she gave me an address. So I had looked it up on a GPS and decided if by a certain time no one showed up at the bar, I'm not sure why she gave me the bar, maybe it was a reference point, but I should drive to the address. And from what I could tell, the address was only about 3 miles or so from the actual bar parking lot. So out I went towards this town. So every road in Italy, it appears, has the word via, V-I-A, appended to it. I think I said this last episode. And I was going to 50 Via Fontanelle, Torre Catania. That was the address for the GPS. And it took me to Torre Catania, which I saw on the map was this little town next to Fuji, where I was staying. Well, unbeknownst to me, when I turned off the main road, it drove me straight up a mountain on a switchback, back and forth, all the way up. And as I had described, every one of these towns seems to be centered around an old church or castle-looking building, and this one was no different. It was on the peak of the mountain, on a back street, and I drove through to the back street to this address where my GPS took me, and I saw a line of country homes, one right next to each other, all had fenced-in yards. I pulled up to number 50, and there was a gentleman out front sitting in his vehicle, and he looked like he was doing some tasks or errands. So I closed the door on my smart car, and I stepped out to the fence, and he recognized me, that I was standing there. And I called to him, and I asked him if he was Giancarlo. He looked confused, but he understood the concept that I didn't speak Italian. And I said, Giancarlo. And he shook his head no, and I pointed to the house to the right and to the house to the left and tried to explain to him, you know, does Giancarlo live there? I think eventually he got the gist of this, and his answer was no. And then what I said to him is, "E pescatore, I'm looking for a beekeeper named Giancarlo." And I typed something in my translator and handed him my phone over the fence. And he looked all frustrated, and he tried to tell me something in rapid Italian. I had no understanding whatsoever, so he gestured to me to get in my car. And after a couple of things, I finally got it. He opened the gate, he got in his car, and out the gate he drove. And I turned around and followed him. Well, the funny thing was, he drove right back down towards the Green Apple Bar and back down this mountaintop with the switchbacks, and he was flying. And I was, you know, my joke was I went around the corners, which are 180 degrees sharp hairpin bends on two wheels in my little smart car. But he drove down the main highway, got to the Green Apple Bar, drove past it, and turned right into this little switchback driveway that ran between the bar and the bus station. I didn't know what he was doing, but I followed him in there. And he drove out around the back of the bus station, around the back of the bar, and came to this little fork in the road and took a left. And there, I had another Italy moment. Ah, there were hives all over the yard. So he pulls up the driveway. He sees a gentleman standing there in a bee suit, Giancarlo. Motions something to him. Giancarlo opens the gate, lets him in. I follow him in, and he gets out of the car, and he starts gesticulating wildly. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The two of them are having a conversation, and he's pointing at me, and he keeps pointing at me. And I guess the gist was, is I have no idea why this crazy American is asking about you, but I brought him here, and he was looking for you. So how cool is that? This utter and complete stranger figured it out, happened to know who Giancarlo was. Maybe it's a small world, and drove me to the guy's house. It was like I was meant to be there. So eventually they had a funny laugh. I could tell they joked about it, whatever. The guy gave a little tip of his cap to Giancarlo, got in his car, didn't even look at me, and off he went back to his house and whatever he was doing that morning. So Giancarlo motioned to me to pull my car in so he could close the gate. And then motioned to me to follow him, and we went in this little shed building, which I think was probably his honey house and his little workshop. And off the side yard in a chain link fence gated in was a rather large garden, and off the far end was his apiary where he had 24 plus hives. So I think he wasn't quite sure what to do with me. He mentioned a couple things, and he went back to his desk. He was working on prepping some frames for grafting. And I recognized what he was doing. And he could see that I recognized what he was doing. And somewhere along the line, it gathered on him that I was a beekeeper. And I had my Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association t-shirt on under my regular shirt. And I pulled my shirt open and showed him. And I mentioned to him, I don't even know if this is proper Italian, but Presidente Association, and I pointed at the bees. And then I think the light bulb went on, and he grasped that I was a beekeeper, and I'm sure he gathered I was from the United States. So he took out his phone after this little awkward discussion about why I was there, tried to take place, and he called somebody, and come to find out, he called Simone. Simone is his friend, who is a beekeeper, and it turns out that he explained to him that this guy showed up, he didn't speak English, and wanted to know if he would translate, so he hands me the phone. So I had the conversation with Simone about what I was there for, and I told him that the hotel sent me. I assumed that Giancarlo knew I was coming. It got relayed that he had no clue why I was there, that I was coming, or anything like that, but took it in stride, apparently. And what Simone said was he had no anticipation of coming over there, but the fact was he'd clear his calendar, again, very hospitable, and come on over and help me with having a conversation with Giancarlo. And I should hang out there. He would be over at noon. And by this time, it was probably about 10:15. So I was sitting there in this awkward spot. Should I leave, go back to the hotel, and come back at noon? Or what should I do? When he hung up the phone, Giancarlo waved me over, showed me a couple things, and then basically just said, come with me. And off we went through the gate, past the chickens, past the garden, and right out into the bee yard. So I should set this up and share that he was in a full suit, head to toe, with a veil, gloves, everything. I was in shorts and a t-shirt. We went right out to the hives, and he started walking through and just pointing at various things. The first, and I'll take you through step by step kind of what he showed me, and I'll relay the experience, because that was what it was all about, after all. The first thing he showed me was pollen traps hanging off the front of the hives. They were the same one I had seen at Co-op Melissa, but here they were in operation. As he pulled out the tray underneath, I was amazed. There was probably a half cup in each one of these trays. He showed me two or three of them, of lemon yellow and some brown mustard-colored pollen. Immediately, I got stung on the arm. So he lit a smoker and smoked my arm for me. And I was interested to see that the smoker fuel was very cool. I don't know if it was impregnated or what, but it was basically just a simple roll of cardboard rolled into a circular form that he could, and it was cut to length so that if you took the roll and put it in the smoker and closed the lid, it would fit perfectly. And he had this butane torch looking thing, which this morning I put one in my wish list for Amazon. And he lit the bottom of his cardboard, and then he put it in, and he used it as a smoker, and he smoked my arm. So all the while he was doing this, I had my cell phone, and I'm recording with it. I brought my GoPro with me. But darn if the battery wasn't dead. I left it on incorrectly and it killed the battery. So I had to use my cell phone. But I got a lot of cool video footage, which, as you know, is going to be on a to-do list to put together at some point and throw up on the YouTube channel. So we opened the first colony, no smoke at the entrance, popped the top off, smoked a little bit into the inner cover, and he pulled some honey frames off the top. I asked him what kind of honey. He said Castagnano, which is chestnut honey. Again, forgive my pronunciation if I say it wrong. What I thought was neat, I watched the way he worked, is he had this long hive tool. It had a blade on one end and a hook on the other. He would hook one end of the frame and pull it up so that it was sitting up a little bit. And then he would go underneath the other end. He would grab the end that was popped up with his fingers and hook the other end and pull the whole frame out in one fell swoop. So this first hive that he opened up and went through was totally loaded with cells of nectar. And the hive configuration appeared to be one deep box. Remember, their deeps are deeper than ours. And two honey boxes, which was unusual for the configuration he had in the yard. In my estimation, it would be similar to our configuration of Langstroth of one deep and two mediums. He buttoned that all up after showing me a bunch of different frames in there, and then he went over to a nuke colony. It was one of those hardened nukes made of polystyrene that I had seen at Co-op Melissa. It had six frames in it, and it had a medium super on top of that was wooden. So it was a full-size deep-style nuke of six frames and then a wooden box on top of it. He pulled the first frame. And now what I think he was doing was he was in his throes of his operation to figure out where he could find eggs to harvest for the queen grafting that he wanted to do that I interrupted. So he started looking around in this for eggs, and I immediately realized that his bees were hot. I got stung again, and then again on the wrists, and made haste to go back to my car after explaining to him that I got stung to get my beekeeping jacket and hood. I returned, suited up. I had jeans on now, and I got stung on the hands. They were the only thing exposed. So Giancarlo gave me some nitrile gloves that he had in a pack there, which is what he was wearing. And then I stood with him the rest of the afternoon, happy that I had an envelope of protection the whole time. So let me spend a minute and run through the rest of the tour. He showed me a hive that had a window in it. It was closest to the garden and explained that it was for the children. I came to learn that he does beekeeping education and brings people in. And I noticed that he has an explanation of beekeeping, bees and their anatomy and stuff on the walls in his honey house and other information. And I guess they bring people in and show them through and do tours with it. He continued to then inspect his hives, pulling frame after frame. And we found a queen after one, and I noticed that it was marked with white paint, which means it was one from this year. And again, I gathered, but could only surmise by his actions that he was looking for eggs to harvest. So determined that he had Italian bees in his apiary, go figure. And I asked him along the way, I mentioned the word Buckfast and Carniolian and other strains, but there didn't appear to be anything but Italian bees, and he indicated that they were Italians. Somewhere in the later conversation, he asked me, do we have Buckfast bees? And he was interested in other strains, but only had Italians in his yard. So it seemed like he was having no luck. And after random reviews of just certain hives that he walked up to, he went to a more tried and true method of pulling out a notebook that he had. And apparently he had notes on every single hive he had in the yard. So from the consultation of the notes, he went to two different nukes to review their content. All of the hives, I noticed, were pretty strong. The first nuke was a little bit small, but we found the queen and there were frames of full complements of larvae, carpet, broods, and full of eggs. So my guess is that was a relatively new queen and that hive was just getting established. The next nuke he opened was ridiculously aggressive. I found it interesting on the one frame he saw a supersedure cell, and immediately he started to pinch any queen cell that he saw. Then as he looked around, he found more, and at first he didn't do anything on them, and I guess he was wondering whether or not the queen was in there. He had second thoughts about it. And again, this hive was just ridiculously aggressive. When I was watching the video back that I shot, the bees were just slamming the camera and me and buzzing him and I the whole time. So it was funny as there was evidence of a previously well-operating queen because there were tons of capped brood in this. And on the final frame he pulled out, he found this large, really plump, beautiful queen, which he picked off the frame. And he marked with white out, and then he took her and put her in a cage. And I wasn't sure if he was pulling that queen, because I had heard Simone on the phone indicating, I think, that he wanted a queen. And one of the reasons he was going to come see Giancarlo was for one. But that was a wrong assertion. And again, I was just trying to figure out by watching. I couldn't communicate. And he did end up actually putting this queen back in. But while he picked the queen off and let her sit in the cage, he went back through the hive at those queen cells that he didn't pinch, and he pinched every single one of them. I don't know if the hive was looking to swarm or he was thwarting it or whatever, but whatever the case was, at the end he just picked that queen up, put it right back in the hive, and buttoned everything back up. Of course, I couldn't ask. I could only speculate. So they went into another full-size colony and inspected frame after frame. This box was amazing. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, Every frame was a full brood frame. Carpets of brood all the way through. This box must have exploded after the day after I left because there were so many bees in waiting there. But the bees were just vicious. He picked out 7 and 8, and the bees went wild trying to defend. And I have to tell you, I was really glad I had protection. Every frame had mature brood. Some of them were carpets all the way through. And it was great, but not what he was looking for. And again, this is where I think I finally figured out that he was looking for eggs to harvest. He took a break going through his hives when I asked him if that was a queen bank, this little tiny hive he had sitting on there. It was a funny little sidebar because he went through and pulled each of these frames out. I'd say they were 5 inches by 5 inches in diameter. There were only 3 of them in this little styrofoam box. But he looked through it 3 or 4 times and could not find the queen. He looked disheveled about it for a moment there. And then I suggested to him that I saw the one frame had a pile of bees that looked really deep. And I pointed at it and said, "Queen, queen." And immediately he got what I was saying and took his finger and started rubbing the bees. And the bees came off the top and underneath them was literally this huge queen. He breathed a visible sigh of relief, as would I have, and he put it all back together. What a cool little box that thing was. So it was neat. In his yard, he had full-size colonies, he had nukes, he had queen mating castles, he had everything, all right there in a single operation. So there was one other specialty box I saw sitting in the yard. It was a dual-chamber hive. He called it Two Family. They don't call it a colony, they call it a family. It was an odd contraption that wasn't in use, but he opened it up and motioned to me what the purpose of it was. It was a long box, very similar to dimension of my top bar. And it was split in the middle. And let me see if I can describe and give it some justice verbally what it looked like. He indicated to me that it only hosted one queen, and it looked like it was some sort of queen-raising contraption. Although maybe it was something similar to the royal jelly one that I saw at Co-op Melissa. So it was the dimension of a typical hive, and it had one extra frame, so it was 12 frames wide. And then all the 12 frames ran across the box. And behind it, it had a dividing wall. And between the two, this common wall was an opening between the chambers. So it had a front cavity and a back cavity. In the back cavity, the frames went in perpendicular to the front cavity. So in the front cavity, from the side wall, they went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way to 12. Then you had the dividing wall behind that cavity. And then the frames went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, but perpendicular to the ones in the front. Go figure, I don't know the purpose of that design. So it seemed to me that he had some sort of queen excluder that he could slide in between the two chambers to prevent queens from passing through. And this thing looked homemade, and I'm not, again, really sure if it was his invention or something that they use in the country. So that's what I could say about it. I'm not exactly sure what it was and didn't remember to ask in the previous or the following conversations when Simone arrived as to what its purpose was. But he did explain to me in broken English that it was something to do with raising queens. So we continued to go through hives. Again, he was looking for this frame that he was going to work with. And at one point, I asked him if I could hold one of the frames. And what I wanted to do was take the cell phone, which I was holding in my hand, and film the way the frame was built. I was holding it in one hand and filming the way the joinery worked and the way the staples worked and the way the wires ran through. Because it's the first time I saw an operational frame. Well, I was twisting it at some point, going back to hand it to him, and I dropped the frame and the bees went all over the place. I have to say, it was really ridiculously embarrassing, but I was mortified. He just kept working on the hive. I handed him the frame back. He kind of giggled and he put it back in the hive and all the bees flew back and nobody mentioned a thing about it. He could tell I was sorry and embarrassed, but what a goofy moment that was. So finally, he found the perfect frame. He went through several more hives before he found the one that he wanted. He continued to look through his notebook for information on what hives he should be checking for the resources he was seeking. And I took the time while he was doing this to step back and take some photos. And it was only when I saw him brushing some bees off of a frame that I figured he finally found what he was looking for. And I understood that because he didn't waste any time. He didn't say anything to me. He picked the frame up and off he went back to the bee house. And I just put my camera away and just trucked in behind him. So I have to say that the next Zen experience was watching him graft. It was so cool, and I took a lot of pictures and video of the experience. We returned to the shed where we started, and he set up the frame on this metal grid that looked a bit like a wire shelf from an old refrigerator. First, he put on these magnifying glasses that help you magnify. You just wear them on your head like a pair of eyeglasses. But he didn't particularly like it, so he switched to this magnifying contraption that he had mounted on an articulating arm. It's one of those see-through ones, similar to a mirror you'd find in a hotel that you look at yourself ultra-magnified, but this one you could see through to the other side. So the next half hour, perhaps more, I watched him expertly scoop out egg by egg from cells and put them in the queen cups that he was preparing when I arrived. He seemed pretty comfortable at this point with me watching and recording with my phone, so I literally got over his shoulder and watched him work. It was pretty damn cool, to say the least. At one point, surprisingly enough, he asked me if he wanted to switch positions. He made it look so easy. I understood the concept of what he was doing. Of course, I knew he was taking 3-day-old eggs or 1-day-old larvae, and scooping them out and putting them in. But I had difficulty in adjusting to the magnification. I had the grafting tool and kept putting it in the cell, but I jam it in there because I couldn't grasp the depth magnification, the depth perception from the magnification of the thing I was looking for. It was only a short moment before I just kind of put my hands up, because it would have taken me a while to get acclimated to it, and just handed him the tool back because I didn't want to hold him up. So he completed several bars and was satisfied with his work. And boom, we headed back outside. He replaced the donor frame to the hive of its origin. And then he put the queen cup frames into a queen production box so the bees would finish the job and raise queens for him. It was cool to watch him. He was deft with what he was doing and clearly experienced and deliberate in his actions. Of course, I was most impressed that he wrote some notes, and then he went back inside. I didn't understand what he was doing, but he got the wire holder and he came back out, brought it out to the apiary, went to a hive, pulled a frame, found some eggs, set it right there on the frame on top of the hive, and proceeded to graft by hand right there in the yard. And I was impressed that he did this with a veil on. Too cool. So he pulled that frame out, and I took the opportunity in the hole to look down inside the hive. I was curious as to whether or not they had screened bottom boards. I really expected to see a solid bottom board, but the fact of the matter was, had a screened bottom board. I was kind of surprised by that. I don't know. It wasn't what I was expecting. So as you would think, he finished grafting what he was doing, put those in that queen castle, and just about the time he finished up, in came a car, which was Simone coming in the driveway. So we went back to his honey house. I'll call it a honey house, shed, whatever you want to call it. It had a main room with shelves that had some honey on it and some other products. It looked like maybe people show up and he would just sell them right out of there. It had a small table and a small refrigerator and the desk that he was working from when he was doing the grafting at the end. And then there was this small room off to the side, presumably used it for storage or whatever he needed. The shed had a screen door that reminded me of my house when I was a kid, the back door. It would open with a really long squeak of the spring, and then it would fling back and slam, bang, every time he opened the door. It shows up in the audio recording I made. I switched to audio, and he kept going in to get things and bring them back out to show them to me, and the door kept slamming. And at some point, I meandered us over to the entryway so that every time the door opened, when the door came back, I reached up with my hand and grabbed it and closed it gently so it didn't slam, because it kept showing up in the recording. I was positive of it. So Simone introduced himself and his son. Then he spent a moment speaking with Giancarlo in Italian. I can only assume that Giancarlo filled him in on the morning activities. And after a short period, he took some time to speak to me. And I explained to him how I got there, why I was in Italy, and of course, why I had come to visit him. We both had a little bit of a laugh at the hotel experience, that the hotel didn't really tell him I was coming. And every once in a while, he'd turn to Giancarlo and relay tidbits of what I was saying. And you could see that he was filling in the gaps for Giancarlo as to what this crazy American was doing there and why the introductions were so confusing. So after a while, the pleasantries turned to conversation about bees and beekeeping practices. And it was a several-hour journey. Much to Simone's son's chagrin, he just sat there patiently and politely. I think he was bored, but at some point, when we started relaying how beekeeping was going in the U.S., he started to take an interest and paid attention and listened. I gather he had some affinity for the bees and was enticed to join along with his father to come to Giancarlo's, with the promise that Giancarlo would take him out to the apiary at some point. So when we first got there, I think his objective was, can we stop talking so he could go out and see the bees? And true to form, partway through our conversation, they took a break and went out to the apiary for about 20 minutes or so while I caught up with Simone on a bunch of different topics. So I came to know during that period that Simone was a fairly new beekeeper and that Giancarlo was his mentor, and Giancarlo had been keeping bees for decades. I mentioned to him that I went to co-op Melissa, and he was familiar with the business, not intimately, but knew of it. But the conversation didn't go any further about that. I didn't go too crazy about relaying what I had done, other than I was familiar with a lot of the equipment that I had seen there. So we reviewed what Giancarlo did this morning to Simone so we'd know what I saw, and they politely answered my questions about their hive management practices, idiosyncrasies in the way that they did some things about their hives. We got to talk a little bit about treatments, which, like Co-op Melissa, sounded very parallel to some of the things that we do. And then they talked to me some about the forage and environments and odds and ends about their hives. While answering questions, they asked me how it worked in the U.S., and I recall much of the conversation to me was about practices in the U.S. so that they could know whether they did things similarly also. So it really was an interesting tit-for-tat exchange. I think I'm not going to go crazy about that, because if you're a regular listener here, you probably know a lot about, you know, the way we do things around here, given the local hive reports. So one of the distinct differences is that they did not appear to be too many beekeepers in that region, given what they said. We have far more per capita in our region here in New Jersey than they had in theirs. I had mentioned to him that I had only seen one beehive establishment down the bottom of the hill going towards Anani, and they knew who that beekeeper was, but mentioned that there were not a lot of others around that area of Fuji. They also found it really amusing when I relayed to them that sometimes we stack our boxes so high that we require a step ladder to get the honey boxes off. And I talked to them a little bit about Tim Tower Hive Ives, and they really found that funny. I could see the smile on his face as he was relaying it to Giancarlo. We spoke a little bit about the complications of pesticides. And Giancarlo fetched his beekeeping magazines from one of the drawers in his desk for me to peruse. It was Italian, in Italian, of course, but it looked very similar to a Bee Culture magazine in format and layout with the ads and the stories and so on. So it was becoming a long day for all of us. I really didn't want to hold his son up that much, and we finished talking, and then much to the chagrin of his son, who, I'm sorry, I don't remember his name. I think they told me right at the beginning, but I'll have to go back and listen to the recording and see if I trapped that. But they started in again on a new thread, and we were there for at least another hour. During that course of that conversation, Giancarlo hustled up to the house at one point and returned with some glasses of mead. And, you know, we ended the conversation with a toast to our newfound friendships and kinship and our love of bees. And they expressed that it was impressive that all of us were for saving the bees and for doing what was right for the environments. I asked for a quick photo. We exchanged some contact information. And then we made our goodbyes. I have to say that, all in all, it was everything that I was asking for a beekeeper visit in Italy. It was amazing. Like the visit with Co-op Melissa and my new friends there, it was just a fantastic experience. What was neat is I got to see the equipment aspect and ask a bunch of questions in the previous day. And then this I literally got to see and work with the bees. And I'm certainly going to reach out to Giancarlo upon any return visits to Italy. And the extension was that if he ever came to the U.S., we would certainly accommodate some visits for them. So all in all, what a great experience. I have to relay that one of the things I did when I pulled out of the gate and had a little more time that afternoon with no other activities is I drove back to Torre Catane. And I drove slowly this time, and I held my phone up through the smart car windshield and filmed the switchbacks driving up the side of the mountain and back. And at some point, just for giggles, I'll post that video so you could see what's what. When I drove up, I drove really slowly. When I drove back, I drove as fast as I could, like a motorcycle, back through slaloming. And it was really, really fun. I'm glad I didn't drive off the side of the mountain trying to do that. But anyway, I'll have that video. You know, I think some of this stuff may end up waiting till after the beekeeping season. I'll try and squeeze it in. But one of the other problems that I had recently is I upgraded my computer to Windows 10. And the software that I used to produce the videos crashed Windows 10 every time I tried to create a video. So I had to write back to the software company, find the utility to uninstall all my products, and reinstall them from scratch. And just yesterday, I was able to make a video of something. So I'm back in business. So yeah, you've probably noticed if you're watching the YouTube channel that there hasn't been any videos posted. That was the reason for concern. And we should be able to get some things up. In fact, I shot some video at Bob Kloss's house the other day that I'll have to produce again, maybe this weekend or next weekend, and get these other videos up. So, yep. I'm rambling, so let's close this segment down. Hope you enjoyed that recount. And if you had any questions about this, let me know. I have their contact information, and I'd be happy to fill in any gaps of things that I left out that you had questions about beekeeping in Italy. To the best of my knowledge, if I know, I will share it. So write me at kevin@bkcorner.org, and keep an eye on our website, and I will also mention in future episodes when I post the pictures of the yard. I took a lot of them that day, and the videos. We have passed through the segment section of this podcast. Let's move to the back of the book, the roundtable section, a smattering of topics in no particular order. First one, roundtable number one, watermelon for bees. I saw a post the other day on Pinterest that had some hives in a yard and a bunch of old watermelon rinds in front of them. The suggestion here is that if you have a watermelon that's past its prime and you're not going to eat it, don't just discard it. Cut it up and expose its flesh to the bees as the love and overripe melon with waters and sugars it provides. I thought this was an appealing notion, as who doesn't have some fruit that goes past its prime, and if watermelon is a prospect for this, what about other fruit sugars? What I learned is this is a more common practice, feeding fruits, for butterflies than it is for bees. A butterfly website gave a smidge of an insight, saying that you should prepare your fruit every day as fruit dehydrates and seals up, and therefore needs to be provided daily to make more juices available. To my way of thinking, this idea seems novel, but it also seems a little fraught with peril, as if it will attract bees, then bees will dominate the fruit and keep mostly everything away in a good situation. In a bad situation, it's going to attract other critters to a feeding frenzy. And I suspect you would see ants, other wasps, and unfriendly critters. That's not something you want to have happen in your apiary. And contextually, I know that I did some open feeding about this time of year one time during the dearth, and it was not a good idea. So it seems to me if you were to do this, put the fruit out, see if the bees take it, and if not, get it out of there pronto. Incidentally, this is not a new concept apparently. I found an interesting thread in a bee forum that debated whether bees actually seek out fruits on plants for a resource. Think of grapes as an example. One camp says they don't bother as they can't or won't chew through the skins to get to the flesh inside. Others say that they learn of fruits and their availability from rotting fruits that are down on the ground, split and mature, and they'll occasionally just seek the nectar and the sugars from the things that are down. And then they'll learn to bite into the fruits to get there to the waters and sugars, especially if they're desperate. Now, I often see grapes down on the ground below our grapevine in the backyard, and I check out everything in my yard for presence of bees, and I can't say that I have ever seen a bee working on those or any of the blueberries that fall from the bush that we have growing in the wild, any of the wild berries that we have, and so on. So I'm skeptical that they would do this unless they're desperate and have never heard or seen bees eating fruits available on trees. Somebody will write me in and tell me I'm dead wrong. That's okay. Now, as to whether they could pierce the skin, come on. Of course they can. Haven't you ever seen them chew through a bottom board or any woodwork? If they want a hole somewhere, they will make one. Now, it might take them a smidge of chomping on a fruit to do it, but I am sure that they could pierce the skin of a grape. But I simply think it's probably more work than they want to bother, and they would just go from flower to flower to flower instead. So I have one more twist on this subject, watermelon for bees. I'm going to go down a different path. There's an old wives' tale out there that speaks of how to select a perfect watermelon. It is said that you look for a bee sting on the surface of the watermelon, and if you see it, you know that it's going to be a sweet and juicy watermelon. A bee sting, in the case of a watermelon, is described as a mark on the watermelon, and it might even be adorned with a little sap-like hard candy on the surface of the watermelon skin. The wives' tale part of this is said that a bee will land and sting the watermelon and then slurp up its goodness, causing this mark to occur. The sugars drain from the watermelon for the bee, and then after it's had its fill, the remaining sugars dry up and harden, making this little hardened candy on the outside, or lines across the watermelon, and so on. I guess, again, I'm not buying this, but apparently this wives' tale has been repeated enough to become folklore, and I chalk it up to some quaint way to talk about a natural occurrence where I would speculate that the watermelon has a porous surface and somehow the sugars were able to penetrate through and form this phenomena of the little hard candy on the outside. So perhaps I shouldn't dash the sentimentality of this notion, and in this end, I have a little treat for you. There's a video of two ladies that are as apple pie discussing the very notion of this bee sting mark on a melon. They are replete with red, white, and blue dresses and discuss the topic and then show you how to properly cut melons. True Americana. I'd encourage you, if you want to see the video in all its glory, to check our show notes for the link. Or you can go, not right now, because you're listening to a podcast, but later, to vimeo.com/, and it's the number for the video, 447-88642. What I suggest you do is the middle. Hang in there. You need to watch to the end. It's very entertaining. The name of it is Picking a Sweet Melon, and it talks about watermelon bee stings. Check it out in our show notes. Round table number 2, Queen Colors. Hold on a second. I have a Kevin moment. I reached in tonight to check on a hive, and I got stung on the end of the index finger of my left hand. Do you know how many times when you type, you hit with that finger? It sends a little bit of pain every single time to remind you of the stupidness of grabbing underneath the frame and not checking for bees. End of Kevin moment. Queen colors. There's an international queen color guide that indicates white is the color of the bees this year. Yellow is next year, red the year after that, and then green, and finally blue. The rotation of what color you mark your queen is predicated on the last digit of the year you are in. What I mean by that is you start with the number 1 of 2011 and begin with white, and you go through the rotation until you get to the year ending in 6 to start all over again. It recycles every 5 years, and that is why 2016 is a white year. So I know this. I've known this for a long time. The problem is I can never remember the order of the colors. Someone relayed this trick to me, and I'm trying my best to commit it to memory, and I'm going to share it with you. We could do this together. So first you have white. That's the first part of this memory game. It helps you to remember that the year that ends in 1 starts with white. The year that ends in 1 starts with white. That's the first thing to remember. The second part of the memory is the moniker. Will you raise good bees? Say with me again. Will you raise good bees? White, yellow, red, green, blue. Will you raise good bees? If you can remember that white comes first, you'll remember that the year that ends in 1 is white. And ask yourself, will you raise good bees? Then you'll know to start with white and follow it with yellow, red, green, blue, as the first letter of your question represents the colors of the queen marking guide. And knowing that it runs in 5-year cycles, you'll be clear about what to do on year 6 of the decade. So one point of this, say you're in 2016 and you encounter a queen that is blue. How old is she? As a rule, queens only produce for about 2 to 3 years, so she's from 2015. She can't be from 2010 because she'd be 6 years old. Queens don't live that long. So you can keep this in mind as a rule of thumb when you look at queens from previous years. She's likely only from a few years back. Will you raise good bees? Will you raise good bees? Will you raise good bees? Say it with me now. Roundtable number 3, I call this one Bob's Bee Emporium. It's the name I came up with on Saturday when I was over to Bob Kloss's house. Walked through his driveway and was amazed at the number of hives he has out in his side yard. I recall when I first met him that there were a handful of hives. Now it looks like a beehive mecca. There's top bar hives and nukes and three deeps and, well, you get the sense in the picture of it. Bob and I were talking recently. We've spent a couple times together at fairs. We did the Warren County Fair and the Hunterdon County Fair together. And just the state of affairs, no pun intended, of how our bees are doing. And as I said in the local hive report, he was interested in helping me out for the top bar that I have and getting that going. So I went over that day to get the resources out of that nucleus top bar hive that he had. So, of course, while I was there, he gave me the tour. Full-size colonies, nukes, top bars, a garden hive. Holy cow, what a way to go. All of his hives look healthy. And it seems to me he's in really good shape for the winter, unlike me. Several of his hives are treatment-free. And at one point, he pulled out a mite count board to show me that there were no mites on the bottom board. I don't think I've ever been in an apiary and pulled one and not seen any. And I promise you, I scoured that bottom board and could not find it. Neither could he. I concur, no mites, duly impressed. Hopefully that is why I am trying to get that teacup of a swarm that found in the tree through. Because if that's the type of genes he has, I want some of that. And hopefully, you know, as we've discussed, that's where we want to be someday, all kidding aside. To that end, I'd love to help him promote his hygienic stock and gene pool in our area, and it so happens that I'll get that chance. So I mentioned I watched a bee fly out of one of his hives at some point. I was watching it oriented in front of us. And while it was circling, I noticed a small swarm hanging in the pine trees over his hives. I pointed it out to him. We were both oblivious. We had stood there in the yard for probably 30 minutes or so. And we decided, yeah, we need to get this swarm, even though we both know that this time of year, picking a swarm out of a tree doesn't make much sense. So Bob got his pole-catching device. We lined up a nuke to use. And we scooped the bees out, and we dumped them into the hive. And the difficulty lies with the first shot we took when we got it up there. Apparently, this swarm has been there a while, because it had already built out three or four combs in the tree. So when we hit that first shot, bees fell in the bucket. By the time we got it down, most of them flew out and went back to the comb, as you would expect. So after two or three shots and getting handfuls of bees, there weren't a ton of them there. There was probably five, six, eight cups, something like that to begin with. I figured out how to get the bottle underneath and move it down and break off some of the comb, figuring if we broke the comb off, we'd get both the queen and the bees, and they would not go back there. So mission accomplished. We dumped it in the hive, and all of a sudden, we started seeing all the bees scenting. And we thought, yeah, we're good to go. So Bob said, you know, let me go get my marker. We'll mark this queen. I said, I'm not fussy about this. No, let me go get it. So he goes into the house. He comes back. He brings a net, one that you use to raise caterpillars. And he says, this is going to be the muff. We're going to get the queen out. We'll trap her in the queen capture device, one of those pinchy things. He told me what it was called. I forget, and I'm drawing a blank. It's late at night, folks. So he catches the queen. He puts her inside the thing. And he's telling the story about how he typically does this inside of the house so that in case she got out, we would at least have her trapped inside the house and not worry about that. But we'll be Atlanta brave. Just go ahead and do it. So you can tell where this is going. He starts to work on the queen, and the queen gets out. Out she goes. I watch her fly out, both of us, to our amazement. And Bob's like, oh, the queen. Queen's gone. I'm watching the queen. She's circling the yard, circling, circling, circling. I'm standing there in the yard doing pirouettes, watching this queen flying one way, flying the other way. It goes up, flies up, comes back down, comes back up, zoo, 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 boom, and it lands on this branch. Probably 30 feet up, just tall enough to reach with the bucket. She's all by herself up there. Nobody's around. So here you have the original collie over in pine trees. There was like 6 or 8 pine trees in a row there in his backyard. They're over to our left. The hive is sitting there in the middle with some of the bees that we captured. And they're now starting to fly out because there's no queen in there. And then over to the right up in the tree is the one by herself. So I said, Bob, what are we going to do here? How would you get her out of that thing? There's no way she's going to come down. Maybe we should just wait. Hopefully the bees will find her. They'll gather back up on her again, and then you could just scoop her out later. I said, but you know what? I have an idea. I took the bucket pole device. I went back over to the other hive, the original swarm location, and whatever bees we didn't catch were now gathered there, and I scooped real quick, got him in the bucket, and walked it across to where the queen was. And I just stood there like the Statue of Liberty, holding the bucket, the collector, underneath where the queen was. And as the bees are exiting the bucket, they're smelling the queen and they're gathering up on her. So I stood there for a good 5 to 10 minutes. And Bob is lapping the yard, upset with himself that the queen got away and that we screwed this all up and whatever. And I said, yeah, be patient. We're going to figure this out, right? So we wait a little while. I take the bucket and I said, okay, here I go. I give one big, huge thrust up, knock the bees into the bucket the best I can. As I'm bringing them down to earth, a couple of the bees are flying away. When I get it back down, I hand it to Bob. And he turns it over, and there's 5 bees inside the thing, and he knocks it off, and he dumps it inside the hive. And before he did it, he just peeked real quick to see whether or not the queen was in there. Didn't see the queen. So I do one more time to make a long story short. Gather the bees, try to do it, try to get them. I can't get any more bees out of that branch. I figured that's it. So we start to lick our wounds. We start to clean up, put materials or whatever. I walk over to the nuke. I look down and I said, Bob, look at all the bees. They're fanning. Now, we had taken that queen clip, that's what it's called, and put it in the hive, hoping that the scent of the queen on the queen clip would keep the bees that we had in the box in there while we marked the queen. So the queen clip was in there, and we were surmising, well, maybe it's the comb pieces that we put in the bottom of the box, and maybe it was the queen clip. I said, I don't know, Bob. There's an awful lot of them scenting in here. I take the frames out, I scour the bottom, and there's the queen down in the bottom. Those 4 or 5 bees that we found on that scoop, one of them was the queen, and she went back inside. So we button everything up, giddy as school kids, laughing at our adventure, and off I go with this hive to go back home. So we button everything up, and now we're back to square one where we wanted to cage this queen and mark her. So we start to look for the queen marking device that Bob had, and we're walking all over the yard. We cannot find it. Where'd you put it? Can't find it. It's not laying on any of the hives. It's not laying around. We're looking across. We go back over to the garden area where the garden hives were and looking for it. Can't find it. So we give up and we decide we're going to put this queen in the cage like our original intention, back to the game plan. But instead of doing it in the side yard, we took the butterfly netting, which we were using as a queen muff, and the queen, which we had in the clip, and we went back into the house. And in the interim, Bob had taken a number of worker bees from that little colony and put them inside the cage so that inside that little butterfly net so that he could take them and put them in the queen cage as the attendants with the queen. So sage wisdom, he gets in the house, he opens a queen clip. The queen is now free inside. He goes to catch the queen. She starts buzzing around and he can't find her. We're looking inside the netting. There's a bunch of bees now in there and the queen. And he's almost got his head basically inside the net looking for the queen. And I look, and there's the queen. She had gotten out, and she was walking on the surface of the netting. I said, Bob, there's your queen. He reaches up and grabs a queen and sticks her back inside the net. He holds the thing closed the best he can. And he proceeds to capture the queen and put her inside the queen cage. I have to say kudos to Bob. He was really adept at this. I was impressed. He grabbed that queen from her wings like a pro and put her in there. And then he reached up, and I had never done this, and I was kind of curious when he did it. He grabbed each one of the attendants that he was going to put in, the workers by the wings, and he put them in the little hole and put them inside the queen cage. So I thought that was really cool. I don't know how you grab a worker by its wings and it doesn't turn around and sting you, but he grabbed four of them and put them in there. Then he mixed up a little bit of candy to plug it, and he closed it all up, and the adventure was over. So we went back in the yard, having laughed through the whole thing. It's so much fun when two people just have a little adventure like this. It makes beekeeping that much better. I take the nuke that now has a caged queen and put it in the truck, and I take the little box that is the top bar nuke and put it in the truck. We're just about ready to leave, and Bob looks down, and he finds the queen that he had taken out of the small top bar nuke and painted, sitting on a concrete block behind the hive. I had almost driven out of the highway out of the driveway without that queen. So I said to him, what are we going to do with this queen? I'm not going to put her back in the hive because I'm going to take those frames and put them in a hive that has a queen. I really want to use the queen for the nuke that I just pulled, where I made the split and left the queen in one and it's queenless in the other. You know what I'll do, Bob? I'll take the whole contraption, the painter device, which is like the little soft plunger that goes up inside of a tube. I'll take that home, and I have this frame thing that I bought from Kelly for the Gadget Garage that you use to introduce queens. I'll put her in there. So using what I learned, I thank Bob for our adventure. We laughed. We were both going to the fair that night. So he was going in to get a shower. I was going home to take care of all the stuff that I had. And I go home. I take the queen inside the house in the small bathroom downstairs, learning from Bob's message. And I go to try and put her inside this cage contraption. Now, she's not in a queen cage, which is how you transfer it. You put the queen cage in open, and she walks out of the queen cage and into this device. I didn't have her in a queen cage. I had her in this plastic plunger thing. So I open it up, and I'm trying to coax her to go in the little hole, and off she goes. So now I get to play my hand to catch a queen. She's walking on the mirror and on the vanity, and I reached up and I got her, brought her down. Missed her, she flew away, back on the mirror. And then she eventually flew over to the curtain. And I kept trying to grab her, but I wasn't as adept at Bob as Bob was at this. Eventually, I was standing on my tippy toes, and she was at the top edge of the curtain. And I managed my last reach and knew that I had only one more chance to grab her, and grabbed her by the wings and brought her down and put her in. And then I used one of those 7-day pill dispensers, so you make sure you remember you took your medicine. I used that to close the space off in a toothpaste tube and coaxed her in the hole, and eventually I finally got her inside that contraption and put it in the hive. The good news is when I put her in the hive that night, they seemed to accept her. They were on the cage, they were feeding her, they were taking care of her. And this morning, I fling that open. Actually, it was Monday morning. I swung the door open and I coaxed the queen to come out, and I saw her climb out and go right down into the hive. So all's well that ends well. I don't know. Maybe it's not as funny when relayed this way, but I have to tell you that Bob, we have so much fun when we beekeep. I know Bob listens to this. And I can only hope that for your sake, if you're a beekeeper, that you can find somebody who shares the same interests as you and has as much fun as we do when we get together. We really have a blast all the time. So I always enjoy my adventures to Bob's Bee Emporium. And, yeah, it was a lot of fun that day. Round table number 4. I did find another topic. It dawned on me tonight that Sharon made something for dinner that she's made 3 times already. When you make a recipe for a third time, you know that it's a keeper. This is one that came from honey.com in one of their newsletters. It's called Fresh Zucchini Toss. And it's zucchini dressed with a honey dressing that alone I think I would drink like a liquid. And it's funny, I'm not fussy. I'll eat a lot of things. I don't particularly like very sweet dressings. It's just not my thing. But I'll drink this stuff right out of the jar if you make it for me. And I'm going to tell you how to make it, and I encourage you to try it out. And I'll also give you a link to it from honey.com. So here's the ingredient list, and I'm going to split it right in the middle, and I'll explain why. It's 1/2 cup of vegetable oil, 1/3 cup of white wine vinegar, 1 clove of garlic minced, 1/3 cup of honey, 1/2 teaspoon of seasoned salt, 1/4 teaspoon of black pepper, 2 cups of zucchini coarsely shredded. The second half of the recipe is 1 head of iceberg lettuce, cored, rinsed, torn into pieces, 1/2 cup of red onion thinly sliced, 1/2 cup of seasoned croutons, and 1 cup of grape tomatoes or tomato wedges. The reason I split it in the middle is, I think it would stand alone without the salad part, just the zucchini soaked in the sauce. And for that matter, as I said on the opening, just leave the zucchini out and drink the sauce. So the way that you make this is it says you combine the first 6 ingredients thoroughly in a blender or shaken in a jar, pour it over the zucchini. The important part, zucchini doesn't have a lot of flavor, so you chill it for 30 minutes or more. Then what you do is you place the lettuce in a large salad bowl, and you add this zucchini mixture and you toss it in, hence the reason they call it a fresh zucchini toss. And then you garnish it with the onion and the croutons and tomatoes. I'm telling you, I don't know what it is about this combination, but it really, really works. Now, we make a couple substitutions based on what we have and some past known stuff from Sharon and how she makes salad dressing. Instead of vegetable oil, we always use a really good olive oil. In fact, I brought some olive oil back in a suitcase from Italy. And we've been using that. So it's going to be spectacular that way. But even regular olive oil would do. It is late, folks. You could tell by my mumble mouth. Instead of white wine vinegar, we always use champagne vinegar in this type of thing. Champagne vinegar is a little more sweet. And it still has that tart acid as a vinegar, but it's a little fresher tasting. Yeah, this stuff is great, really. Maybe the great is in the eye of the beholder. Sometimes you try these things and go, I don't know what all the fuss was about. But we've served this to a bunch of different people, and everybody's like, man, this is pretty amazing. And we like honey.com recipes, but for whatever reason, this one stands out. In fact, in between round tables, I ran upstairs, and Sharon has it literally on a magnet on the refrigerator. That's how much she likes it. Honey.com, look for Fresh Zucchini Toss. And we'll also have a link in the show notes directly to the recipe. Enjoy it. Well, you know, I had a couple listener mails prepped, but it's approaching midnight, and I need to go to bed because I have to go to work tomorrow. So let me go ahead and roll through a couple closing comments. First thing is, the fairs are over. For us in our Beekeepers Association, a significant amount of work goes in from the volunteers, and especially our fair coordinators, to operate our booths for the 2 weeks that we operated the Warren County Fair and then this past week at the Hunterdon County Fair. I can't thank our chairman enough and the people who volunteer, but especially our executive board, as they do a lot of the heavy lifting for volunteering. And as I've shared on a number of occasions every year, this time is really an enjoyable experience to go there and talk to people. I have to say, this year, among other years, I spent more time in the booth, like literally just kept talking. A group would listen to the first part and walk away, and a whole new group would walk up and just kept going. At one point, I looked over, and it was past 10 o'clock, and they had closed our entire booth down, and I still had a crowd standing there, so I had to beg off and go to bed, you know, let everybody go. Listener mail is on my mind. I'll circle back next episode. I do plan to get those adjuncts out, the Italy conversations or whatever, hopefully in the next week or two, and not let them get stale. Next episode, I look to do the EAS special, Eastern Apiculture Society, as I had said in the previous episode, and I'll reiterate it here. I have a lot of footage and coverage to bring for that. We're approaching episode number 100. Do I make a big deal of that? I'm excited that that milestone is coming, but it's hard to say I'm going to do anything special, because anything special usually requires more work on my part than I don't have time right now. You know, I'm a little low-key person when it comes to some of this stuff. Case in point, happy birthday to my twin brother Keith. August 30th is his birthday. Know what that means, since I'm a twin? Danny, my son, Carrie Ann, my niece, CJ, my nephew, Keith and I, all born August 30th. So it's always a big party this time of year. Mentally, not physically, sometimes physically. The odd thing about this is there's something about this date. It was Sharon's grandfather's birthday when he was with us. And I have a cousin whose birthday is on the 29th. And she missed it by just a couple hours. This year is the big 50, and I'm going to go low-key. No party, Sharon. I'm not a person, as I just said, to make a big deal of these life events, but I guess when they come with a zero on the end of them, you have to consider what the decade brings. And one of the things I had as an objective, which I'm well on my way to, was being fit by 50. If you've seen any pictures or videos of me recently, you've noticed that I've lost a lot of weight, which was one of the main objectives to getting to be this age, and feel pretty good about myself. Had a good year beekeeping, feel a lot more fit and so on from that standpoint. And, you know, like everything in life, certain things require attention, and I don't, again, like to talk about all this stuff generally, but, you know, every once in a while it gets you in a reflective mood. So with that, I'll say happy birthday, everybody, and remind you that, like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everyone, and be well.